It's time for another edition of the Executive Suite. I'm Deb Placey, and today we're at the NHL offices in Manhattan to spend some time with the star running back of the 1985 Dartmouth Big Green, but really you know him as Bill Daly, the Deputy Commissioner of the NHL. We're excited to chat. So just to give the listeners a few things on the agenda, we will talk a little bit about football. I heard you're a very big Miami Dolphins fan also.
I am.
But we'll talk plenty of hockey. I promise we won't bore anybody with collective bargaining, but but I do want to ask you a few things about it, including, you know, I want to go into that room that was a 27-hour marathon where the season was saved a few years ago. We'll talk about that. But basically what a typical day is like for you, what's the tough part of your job, sort of some of the best parts of your job, some of the tough calls you have to make, that kind of thing. We'll talk about, you know, your family a little bit and,
sure,
and how you got here, your road.
Sure.
To the executive suite.
That's right.
I know you go to a lot of games. That's probably one of the best parts of your job. But let's start there. As a kid, you went to games at Madison Square Garden.
Yes, I did.
Can we tell people that your family were Rangers season ticket holders?
Yes, they were. My father, my mom is a native Canadian. So she came to the States when she was, I think, a junior in high school. And ended up meeting my father here. My father didn't have a background in hockey, but as a couple, he actually became a New York Ranger fan, ended up having season tickets to the Rangers. He used them primarily for his business, but when I became a big fan, it was a great way for me to bond with my dad. He used to take me to weeknight games, and at that time, the Rangers played the bulk of their home games on Wednesday nights and Sunday nights. And my mom was nice enough to let me go to a lot of games during the regular season on school nights. And we would stop at Howard Johnson's on the way home and have Sundays and eat clam boats because they were good at Howard Johnson's. So actually, it was a great bonding experience for me and my father. We were both big Ranger fans, and it was kind of an interesting time period for the Rangers as well.
What was that time period like? Who was your guy?
So, you know, I knew that question was coming. So, you know, I thought back at the time. So I became a fan of the Rangers really the year they went to the Stanley Cup Finals in 1972 against the Boston Bruins. And at that time, I would say my favorite player was probably Walter Kachuk. Who was a second-line center. Was center of the Bulldog line. I liked his work ethic. I liked the way he kind of handled the media and handled the press. You know, the bigger profile players, you know, Roger Bear and Jean Rattel and Vic Hatfield at the time, the goal of game line, they got all the headlines. But I thought, I just liked the way Walt conducted himself. I was a big fan of his early on. The Rangers went into a tough period, when they put Ed Jockman on waivers, and Emil Francis ended up getting let go, and John Ferguson came in, and Jean-Guy Talbot, and they missed the playoffs a couple times in the mid-1970s. That's really when my father acquired the season ticket. So I saw some lean years in the mid-70s, and then there was kind of a resurgence toward the end of the 70s when they hired Fred Shiro to be the head coach, and ultimately Craig Patrick, and they had a couple good years, including going to the Stanley Cup Final in 1979. And so kind of during that time period, I was a big Ulf Nielsen fan when he and Anders Hedberg were signed by the Rangers, I think for the 78-79 season. Don Maloney came up during that season. I was a huge Don Maloney fan. Loved his work ethic, loved his enthusiasm on the ice, you know, his passion for the game, the way he emoted for the game. And obviously his brother was the captain of the team at the time, Dave Maloney. Both good hockey people today, and I consider them both friends. And then kind of toward the mid-80s, I became a big Barry Beck fan when Barry got traded to the Rangers from the Colorado Rockies. So those, I would say, are the Rangers that kind of stood out for me as kind of my favorites when I was growing up.
So high school, right in New Jersey, you're a local kid.
Yes.
What do you remember about those days back in high school?
Well, I think, I grew up in a kind of a middle-class town, fairly small town in northwestern New Jersey called Kinlan. We had a fairly small high school. You know, obviously I played football when I was in high school. I also played hockey when I could. It was less organized back then. I did live in a lake community, and it was at a time in our evolution where lakes and ponds froze over in northern New Jersey.
So they anymore.
No. So we had a rec program for hockey with a rink, a natural rink that was set up every winter behind our municipal building in Kinnelon. I played in that league, and then me and my friends used to go to the pond or the lake, Lake Reality, which is the community I lived in.
Lake Reality, what a place to grow
yeah,
up.
Exactly. hadn't really focused on that recently, but yeah, so that, and then, you know, I enjoyed sports. I always enjoyed sports. So I played baseball, and when I was in high school, I ran track, but I primarily ran track because, you know, my football coach told me I should be running track if I wanted to go on and play football. So I had good friends. I continue to have some of them today who I went to high school with and grew up with. So it was a great childhood.
I was actually thinking about this, looking at the Ranger roster from about the time that I thought you'd probably be going to games. And I just happened to notice Nick Fatiu is from Staten Island. I mean, there was nobody from the States back then, and he obviously stands out, but there weren't really any players from New Jersey back then.
No.
And now, you know, some of the best players in the league, Johnny Gaudreau, Kyle Palmieri, the Van Riemsdyks, so many players in the league now from Jersey.
Yeah, it certainly at the time I was going, there was, I think really two indoor rinks in, you know, within an hour's drive of where I lived. One was in West Orange,
where the Devils practiced
for years. And the other was in Muncie, New York. And we got to the end of our season, and we occasionally would get ice time to play our games in one of those two facilities. But the ice time at that time was 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. because they would book them 24/7 because there just wasn't enough artificial ice. And so the whole landscape of high school hockey, prep school hockey, and college hockey in New Jersey has changed dramatically since I was a kid, for sure.
So we can touch on your mom because you said she's from Canada. I wanted to ask you about where she, you know, Canada's very big.
Right.
Where is she from, and how did she actually even meet your dad? How did you end up in New Jersey, I guess?
So my mom is originally from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which is out west and very close to where Gordie Howe grew up and played his youth hockey. And actually, she was a contemporary of Gordie.
Oh.
And she, her mother, my grandmother, was married to an athlete, actually, a Canadian diver.
Wow.
Who, was, a premier kind of Canadian diver. He ultimately, went on to be recognized in, I think, the Saskatoon Sports Hall of Fame, and maybe the Saskatchewan Hall of Fame, I'm not sure, and ended up being a firefighter for the Royal Canadian Armed Forces in World War II.
Wow.
And lost his life in a bombing raid in England. So my mom was only 5 years old at the time, so she never really knew him, and I obviously didn't know him. My grandmother remarried when my mother was a teenager, and she remarried an engineer who worked for a company who transferred him to Boonton, New Jersey, in his job, which is obviously transborder. So she moved during her high school years to Boonton, New Jersey, and that's where my father was from. And that's where they ultimately met. He was like 5 years older than her, so he was already out of high school. But they met in Boonton and ultimately got married.
And so the Humboldt tragedy touched you, as it touched anybody.
Everybody. Right. For sure. I have to be honest, I've not spent a lot of time in Saskatchewan. I despite my job and despite, having a summer home in Canada when I was growing up, We had some property in New Brunswick and the Maritimes, so I spent a lot of time in Canada, but I can't say I've spent a lot of time in Saskatchewan. I don't know if it was my first time in Saskatchewan, but I went up recently, the start of their season this year, as a tribute to the Humboldt Broncos and getting the community's life back in order and obviously touch the hockey community and touch beyond the hockey community is life-changing event for sure.
How are they doing?
All indications are, they're making progress. I mean, it's nothing you're ever going to forget, but you learn lessons from it and you move on and you be strong. And I think they've certainly demonstrated that strength.
So I'm guessing you will go back to Saskatchewan for the Heritage Game when Saskatchewan hosts it next year, right?
Yeah, we're actually really looking forward to it, going back there. We understand. I have not been there personally, but the new football stadium in Regina is a gorgeous facility. One of our challenges with the Heritage Classic is finding the right types of facilities throughout Canada because they're far more numerous here in the States than they are in Canada. And from what I understand, this is a first-rate facility, very similar to the Winnipeg facility that we had the last Heritage Classic game in. And we're looking forward to really playing kind of in a neutral site for the first time with the Heritage Classic. So really looking forward to that.
So how'd you end up at Dartmouth?
So I ended up at Dartmouth probably primarily for football reasons. Not for football reasons, because of football. Because I ultimately, chose the college that was best for me for academic reasons. Because I played football in high school, I got recruited by a number of kind of smaller East Coast liberal arts schools, probably four or five Ivy League schools, Colgate, Lehigh, Lafayette, Bucknell, and the only big-time school that actually I got some interest from was Penn State.
That's big time.
My dad had gone to Penn State, didn't play sports there, but was a Penn State graduate. I grew up a Penn State college football fan because of my father, but ultimately I decided that I should be making my college choice based on my long-term career ambitions as opposed to short-time football success or lack thereof, depending on how you look at it. And ultimately I thought, after all my recruiting trips, I thought Dartmouth was a good fit for me, and that's where I ended up going.
So I know we're doing a podcast, you can't see this, but we found some of your box scores from Dartmouth.
Okay.
You were very good.
That must have been difficult.
Well, it's still in the old-fashioned, like, typewriter font, but you were, like, the second leading scorer on your team. What kind of, and you scored a lot of touchdowns. What kind of running back, like, how would you describe yourself as an athlete? You're shifty. What kind of running back were you?
So it's a great question. I would say in high school, I was pretty fast for kind of my level, in my competition. So I would say I was much more of an outside runner in high school and kind of had a lot of breakaway type runs, long runs turned into long runs. That's kind of the fun way to play. And then that probably continued into my freshman year at Dartmouth. I had a pretty good freshman year with the freshman squad at Dartmouth. And then the last game of my freshman year, I ended up tearing my ACL. Had to have knee endings. It was the last game of the year, so had to have surgery. First time I had surgery in my life. And, I had to rehab the knee the entire off season, and spent a lot of time in the weight room.
Wow.
and pushed a lot of iron and bulked up a little bit and got a lot bigger. That injury totally changed my running style. I became much more of an inside runner. That's when I was relied on to kind of pound the ball a little more.
Interesting,
And so I'd say my last 3 years of college, I was not much of an outside runner and certainly not a breakaway runner, but I was good for 4 or 5 yards a pop.
I have to say, though, just one funny thing. The one thing I did see, we found like every year,
You did good research.
Well,
somebody did good research.
There is you are listed on the for the year-end stats as being one of the five receivers to have caught a pass. You caught one pass for minus 6 yards.
Okay.
So what happened on that play?
I think that must have been my sophomore year. It probably was my sophomore year. The interesting part of my sophomore year is I really didn't get to play at all. Right.
Yeah.
It was my first year on varsity. So I saw the field very limited amounts of time, maybe some kickoff duty, maybe some punt return duty. But the last game of the year, we played against the University of Pennsylvania, and we were playing for the Ivy League championship. We both had identical records, and they don't have playoffs, obviously, and they still don't have playoffs in the Ivy League. So the winner was to take all, and we were at Franklin Field in Philadelphia, and I remember we were down, it was either 28-0 or 35-0 at halftime.
So it was close.
and close enough that the coach felt very comfortable sticking me in for the second half. So I got to play the whole second half, and the game happened to be on ABC, and it was before the NCAA decision. So they actually televised Ivy League college football on the big networks. It was regionalized, but throughout the Northeast, I was on ABC, so my friends and family could see me. And I actually had a pretty good second half because I'm sure we were playing, you know, Penn's third or fourth string defense at that point in time. But it was good. I think I must have caught that pass during the second half. It just happened to be it didn't develop as it was
okay.
Drawn up.
Okay, so I'm listening to your Total Recall here, which obviously leads to a couple general managers have said about you that, you know, they can talk to you during the day or first thing in the morning, and you will know if they won or lost last night, who scored, what happened in the game. Obviously, you want to know if they won or lost because you know if they're in a good mood or not, I guess. But in general, you really are on top of all these games every night in the daily course of your job.
Well, I mean, one of the great things about my job and my profession is that, you know, I love what I do, right? So, you know, we talked a little bit about my hockey background, my fandom as a kid. And, you know, hockey was clearly the center of my life, you know, from 8 years old on. And to the extent I ever got away from it was for a very short period of time early in my professional career as being kind of like an every night thing for me. So I lived and died hockey. So for me, now, as part of my profession, to be able to go home at night and watch games until the wee hours of the morning, see every game, and to be able to go to all the games I get to go to, I mean, it's kind of like a dream come true. So it's very easy for me to kind of follow the game, to kind of know what's going on, you know, to know the players, or certainly know of the players and their capabilities, and I, you know, I love watching what they do. I mean, we're very, very fortunate, not only with the quality of person that comes into our game and plays our game and represents our game, but the quality of athlete. I mean, I put our athletes above all other athletes in professional sports, just in terms of the skill and the dedication and the passion that it takes to play our game. So, you know, I'm a big fan.
When we had Gary Bettman on, he talked about at some point wanting to become a lawyer and going to law school, and then he was with David Stern and ended up going into sports law. But as a kid, it sounds like you knew you wanted to go into sports law. I mean, how does a kid know that that's what they want to do?
You said it. I think I always wanted to stay close to sports. It was a comfort zone for me. Obviously, you know, I participated heavily in sports growing up. I was a big fan of all sports, really. You know, maybe a small exception for basketball. I was probably a casual basketball fan. Not anything more, but you know, as much as I loved hockey, I also liked football. I liked baseball. So, you know, I grew up around sports. And yes, that was definitely my objective when I went to college. And then when I went on to law school, that I ultimately wanted to work in sports. You know, when I came out of law school, I worked for a private law firm for a number of years who did some sports work. And I was able to kind of get into that area and be relied on in that area. So I was loving what I did. And I had a couple opportunities over kind of my first couple years at Skadden Arps to pursue a job with a team or league. But I, you know, I was doing sports already, and I really loved what I was doing with the private law firm. So it was really until this opportunity came along that I even thought of having to go elsewhere to practice in kind of the industry that I loved, which was sports.
It seems you've always stood out, even at this law firm when you were young. You stood out. Is there something about your mind that works in that legal way? Why do you think you stood out?
That's a tougher one for me to answer. I think I'm passionate about everything I do, and I like to think that I work hard, and I think that's can be a big advantage if you really love what you do and you work hard at it. You're likely to be successful at it. So that's I think I always wanted to make sure I was giving it 110% in everything I did.
So I have in my notes here that one of the first lawsuits you ever worked on was an NFL lawsuit, right? You represented the NFL against the USFL.
Yes.
And the first thing I thought of was Donald Trump.
Yes.
Was he a part of that, really?
He was a very big part of that lawsuit, yes. Donald, at the time, obviously bought into the United States Football League toward the end of its kind of, the last 2 years of its three-year existence. He bought the New Jersey Generals in the New York area. And one of his strategies, I think at the time both he bought the Generals and thereafter, was to kind of force a merger with the National Football League. That caused the USFL's board of governors or owners to change direction from a spring league, which would theoretically complement the NFL, to a fall concept, which would have gone head-to-head with the NFL. And at the same time, they filed an antitrust lawsuit suggesting the NFL had monopolized professional football in the United States. And he was, he was kind of the principal antagonist at the time. To the National Football League, and fortunately for the National Football League, while they lost a liability verdict, the jury went on to award only $1 in damages, which was trebled to $3, and essentially put the USFL out of business permanently. The thought process was that the USFL, really by changing their strategy, had caused their own damage, and it wasn't the NFL that put them out of business. They put themselves out of business.
What do you remember about then moving to the NHL? Gary tells a funny story about when he did the interview with the league. He ended up taking a couple days and negotiating. It sounds like you took a couple days as well to accept. What do you remember about that story and about interviewing and coming to the league?
I didn't, Gary's interview was with very powerful owners. My interview was with a very powerful commissioner. So I felt honored, privileged, very fortunate to even get an opportunity to interview for the position I was interviewing for, which was, to be clear, was to take over for Jeff Pasch, who was considering at the time moving on to the National Football League, ultimately did move on to the National Football League. Actually, I'm sure had decided he was moving on to the National Football League at the time. So it was really as a chief legal position. And at the time, I was 32 years old. I was a fifth-year associate at Skadden Arps. As I indicated before, I was really enjoying what I was doing. Hopefully had a future in the firm as a partner in the firm. So it was only really the unique opportunity that I would have even considered leaving Skadden for. But this was a unique opportunity, and it was in the sport that, I grew up loving. And I had the opportunity to come in and meet with Gary. Gary had me meet with Steve Solomon at the time, who was kind of our chief business person, executive vice president in charge of our business at the time. And then I met with Brian Burke, Who was, everybody knows Brian.
Brian is always in these job interview scenarios. Actually, he's the one that Gary tells the funny story about that met him in the lobby bar in Toronto.
Yes.
And he said, they're going to love you. You're short, you're a lawyer, and you're a New Yorker. Yeah. Welcome to the NHL.
Exactly right. Brian, so I met with both Steve and Brian, and I think Gary got back to me either the same day or the next day. To make the offer to me, and I think it was December 6th of 1996, and the reason I remember that it happens to be my dad's birthday, and it was a Friday, and you know I said let me take it back and talk to my family and you know I'll try to get back to you quickly, and you know so I took the weekend, you know I'm not sure I needed the weekend. I did have a fairly more difficult than I anticipated discussion with my wife at the time, which was my first wife. She said, you know, be sure you're doing the right thing. You know, you're doing well in your current career and with your current employer, and you have a bright future there. And make sure you're not, you know, making a mistake in doing this. So, you know, I that was probably my only cause for hesitation, and I didn't really have much hesitation. And she supported, ultimately, the decision I made. So, you know, I got back to Gary first thing Monday morning, and I started work for the league. I was working on a case for Skadden at the time for the NFL. It was involved in another antitrust litigation involving the Los Angeles Rams move to St. Louis and the terms that the NFL charged in connection with their relocation from Los Angeles to St. Louis. Of course, now, 22 years later, they're back in Los Angeles. But we kind of picked a break time in that case preparation where Skadden was comfortable with me transitioning to work at the National Hockey League. So it really took... I think my first day on the job at the National Hockey League was All-Star Weekend in San Jose. Last time we were in San Jose.
About full circle.
In 1997. So that was it. That was when I started.
And you also went to NYU, so you're kind of in the city. You're working at the NHL. I think back then you were probably a yuppie. Remember they had those young urban professionals. What was the city like during that time? And as the NHL was beginning to grow, what was New York like that during that time?
Well, the league was a lot different. You know, I went to NYU, I'm trying to think, so it would have been the very late 80s. You know, I had spent a year between Dartmouth College and going to NYU Law School, where I worked at Skadden as a legal assistant. That's actually when I worked on the USFL case. And, you know, it was a different time period there during the 80s in New York City. And it was very yuppie, and there was very power ties and lunches,
and
long
like
lunches.
Wall Street and
yeah, it was... Yeah, it was like Wall Street, the movie, right? So, and it really was like that—the really long lunches and you know the 2-3 martini lunches. I never was a big martini fan; just beer for me. But in any event, it was a different era for sure. And then you know through the 90s, it evolved and it continues to evolve today. So it's different. The league itself obviously was a lot smaller when I joined it. Wasn't as small as when Gary took over. It had already been professionalized to a large extent, you know, by Gary and the people he brought in to run and administer the league. It had already started to become a much bigger organization, and it was a fairly big organization by the time I got here. It's certainly, you know, dwarfed by today's organization. But, you know, as Gary would say, I mean, we continue to do kind of a full-service professional sports league, which has kind of changed over time in terms of what we do and what we're responsible for. And we do it with certainly a lot less resources than some of the other major professional sports leagues. So while we're big and by a lot of measures very big, we're small in comparison to a lot of the other professional professional sports leagues.
What's the most important thing for you going on right now at the NHL? What keeps you up at night, or what gets you excited?
Our games continue to get me excited. I continue to love going home and watching games. And you know, we just came out of the Christmas break period where there were three nights without NHL hockey in the middle of the season. That's tough. Sometimes it's great being with family and not having other obligations in the evening. But you know, you're kind of missing the game by the time it comes back on the 27th of December.
I definitely was.
And you know, we're going to have it again over the All-Star break, and we have we've now built in, you know, through collective bargaining into our system, you know, these other breaks that we provide the players during the course of the season. So that's kind of morphed over time. Biggest concern, biggest worry. I mean, my job, the best thing about my job is that it is so diverse. There are so many different things that I have to worry about, so many different things I can focus on, so many different things that come up from time to time, and sometimes out of the blue, that my days are always full, and there's always something to do, and there's always something that should be getting done that's not getting done. Right now
there's not one main thing that you're
I wouldn't, you know, as I sit here today, I'll continue to think about it.
Okay.
but I think it's really just day-to-day normal stuff.
So talking about watching the games, and now you can watch them on your phone, you can watch them out to the games, out to dinner, iPad in bed, on an airplane. It's crazy. And I know you're involved in a lot of the negotiating with contracts with the networks and in Canada and in the States. What's next? I mean, where are we with all these games you can watch, whether it's on your TV, you get the package or those kinds of things? What's next?
Well, I mean, I think technology will continue to evolve. But to your point, I think it's evolved, you know, tremendously to this point. And, you know, the way we packaged and sold our media rights in Canada, where there was really kind of, we sold them all to one provider and work with that provider, but on a whole bunch of different packages, and how that content is delivered digitally over the air by cable and the like. That's a reality now where you certainly have that option. You can bundle your rights and you can slice and dice them in ways that you never would have been able to before. And it provides a lot of flexibility as we approach our next media rights negotiation in the United States, which is only a couple years away, and we prepare for that. You know, our flexibility in really developing rights packages is endless, and that wasn't always the case, obviously. And you know, it used to be, you know, over the air cable one package for over the air one package for cable, didn't really have a digital option at all. Then, you know, NHL.com came along and evolved, but it was, you know, you weren't streaming games. All of that is new, and I expect that, you know, that technology will continue to improve and evolve, and will continue to provide value both for our fans but also for the leagues and our rights holders.
It's interesting that back in the day, there was a thought by some executives that if you gave away too much of the product, you know, fans wouldn't come to the game or pay for tickets. And then the competing philosophy was the more people see, the more they love it, and the more that they'll come. And that's obviously proven to be true. But in terms of monopolies, I mean, in Canada, it's one provider. In the States, it is. How are you finding that has worked? Would you like to see that change? The more the merrier. I know ESPN Plus now has some games. How do you see that going forward with the big companies, maintaining a lot of the rights?
Well, I mean, I don't think we have necessarily a preferred alternative. I mean, what you're looking for is creating connectivity with your fans and accessibility of your product and your content. And you want to push it out in as many different ways on as many different platforms as you can. And you want to monetize that the best you can. And so that's why I say there's so much flexibility in creating packages and selling packages and marketing packages in dealing with rights holders. The identity of people who can buy our rights or are interested in buying our rights or interested in distributing our rights has grown tremendously over, you know, the last 5 years, just in terms of people who want to play in the space, people who can play in the space. Obviously, you know, the internet and the ability to distribute digitally has really changed the landscape in a dramatic way, and I expect that will continue.
So you think Amazon or Prime Video, those kinds of companies, will ESPN want to get back into the broadcast of the NHL?
Yeah, look, I'm not going to presuppose, you know, what our negotiation holds, and I want to preface it by saying, you know, we have a fantastic partner currently in NBC. They were there for us when others weren't. They've done a fantastic job in promoting our sport and moving it forward. And I certainly could see being with them into the future. All I'm trying to emphasize is the number of people out there who can play in the market and can participate in the market in a meaningful way has expanded dramatically.
Okay, hard-hitting question. How many times have you been to Disney World?
Too many times for me to be able to count. I am a frequent visitor of Disney World. My wife and my son and I are annual pass holders for Walt Disney World.
So what does that mean? You can go in and out anytime?
In and out anytime, any park. And quite frankly, given the prices today admission-wise, it's like a brilliant
steal.
Move. A brilliant move.
Can we get one of those for the NHL? Yes,
it's a great question because I think our clubs are very becoming creative in how they package those things, dynamic pricing and the like. It certainly works for us, and we enjoy going.
So how did that start?
I was always a big Disney fan growing up. My grandparents moved to Florida when I was, you know, probably even before I started watching hockey. When I was a kid, or about the same time, maybe. And so we used to go down to visit them, and we'd make the annual pilgrimage to Walt Disney World. And then, throughout my college years and law school years, even before I had kids, I enjoyed the Disney experience, and that continued. My two older kids, I have a 22-year-old and a 20-year-old, they went through their Disney phase. And then there was like this period where I didn't have kids at the right age. We probably took a little hiatus from Walt Disney World, but now I have a 9-year-old, and at least for the last 4 or 5 years, he's loved Disney. So,
what is your favorite ride?
It's a good question. I still love Space Mountain. My son, my 9-year-old, loves Expedition Everest. He ranks that on his highest. Yeah, I could really go on any of them.
I'm kind of a sucker for It's a Small World.
Yeah. You know what? I haven't gone on in a while, I can understand why you're a sucker for it.
Yes. It's very, so, appealing. I don't know. Yeah. It's so quaint.
It's very quaint. And it's
emotional.
Very quaint.
Yeah. And maybe on a little bit more serious note, they're in the entertainment business as you are. Do you sometimes take mental notes? Do you take note of what they do as an entertainment business, the way they run things?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, the kind of the consumer-friendly, fan-friendly environment that you get when you go there, it's clearly ingrained in their culture. And I think a lot of our clubs and the league as well focuses on servicing their customers. And that has to be kind of the number one priority. And I think a lot of companies can and have learned from that aspect of the Disney culture, for sure.
I mentioned it that you're a big Dolphin fan. Did that come from going down to Florida, or how did that happen?
No, that's a longer story, and that is before I actually became a big fan of hockey, although comparable time period. But that goes back to Christmas Day 1971. The Miami Dolphins played the longest game ever played in the NFL history against the Kansas City Chiefs. It was a playoff game, and my father and my uncle were watching the game and had a friendly bet on the game, $5 bet on the game. And my cousin and I were both, I guess we were 6 years old at the time. We were playing Spider-Man, not paying attention to the game at all. And our fathers asked whether we wanted a kind of a piece of the action. And my father happened to be rooting for, or having chosen the Dolphins that day. And my uncle had chose the Chiefs, not that they had any affiliation as who they wanted to win or thought would win that game. And so, of course, I picked the Dolphins, and my cousin picked the Chiefs, and the Dolphins ended up winning. And I won a dollar as a six-year-old. That was a pretty
significant
big take.
Significant change.
It was a pretty big take. And the Dolphins that year went on to their first Super Bowl, losing convincingly to the Dallas Cowboys. But the following season, they were 17-0, the league's only undefeated team, and probably will be the only undefeated team ever in my lifetime. And then the following season, won a second Super Bowl, 15-2. And at that age, when you're following a team and they win two championships, you're kind of hooked for life. And so that was my experience too. And I will say, like, for the first portion of my life, they were always a competitive team. They were like one of the kind of the national teams. You had the Cowboys, you had the Packers, you had the Raiders, you had the Steelers, and you had the Dolphins. Dolphins were in that conversation. It's kind of changed since Dan Marino retired. I can't say that I'm real proud with their recent efforts in recent years, but you have to remain a fan, and I remain a big fan and follower.
I just saw Dan Marino. He was on the field at the Orange Bowl talking to some of the young quarterbacks, and we were joking, you know, nobody's got an arm like he does, yeah. Or he did.
Well, he was amazing. I mean, you know, if you're a Dolphin fan and you got to live through the Marino years, and I still make it a point to try to get down there during the season to see a game in Miami. I typically like to avoid the games when they're in market in New York, just because historically haven't always been the nicest reception that I would get wearing a Dolphin jersey. He had a tremendous career, and I wish for his sake he had had an opportunity to win or go to another Super Bowl and have an opportunity to win it, because he is one of the all-time greats.
So you won a dollar. You were on the cusp. You were in the beginning stages of sports gambling. Who knew?
Sports betting. Exactly right. That's an admission, I guess. Hopefully not against interest.
That's a big topic. Just give us your take on where the league is now and how you think it's being handled, sort of a half year into, you know, your first experience with it, now that it's legal in New Jersey and some of the things are happening.
Well, I think I'll start by saying that historically, you know, we were not at the forefront of wanting, the liberalization of sports betting laws in this country. As a matter of fact, you know, the commissioner in his prior life with the NBA, played a principal role in helping to get the federal legislation passed that prohibited states from legalizing sports betting in the United States. Over a period, I think that legislation was passed in the early 90s and lived on, basically for a quarter of a decade. So, we weren't active in lobbying. As a matter of fact, we opposed states who tried to pass state legislation that was inconsistent with the federal legislation. But ultimately, kind of the world, either caught up or passed us by. And the Supreme Court ruled what they did, and certainly made sports betting a reality, and it's going to become an increasing reality, bigger reality, as we move forward from state to state. I think we have to embrace that and work with it and try to optimize it.
So far, though, it has not intruded. For most who don't want to participate, and it's there, it seems, for those who do.
I think that's right. I mean, look, I think what we see now is a real engagement opportunity, right? To engage not only with new fans, but to engage on a different level with existing fans in terms of their interest level and what they're looking at, and particularly in today's world in the new millennium where, little bits of time. I mean, hopefully most of our fans can sit down and watch a full hockey game and be entertained. But, the world is moving toward bits and pieces of information and short attention spans. And I think kind of the sports betting angle can really service those types of fans in ways that maybe a prior experience didn't service those fans.
So you don't get booed everywhere you go, right? You're not there yet.
that's the way I'd put it. I'm not there yet.
But in reality, you do, and you did a lot of the negotiating that commissioner takes, you know, a lot of heat for with the work stoppages over the years. What kind of negotiator would you say you are? How would you describe yourself as a negotiator?
Hopefully a good one. You know what? I think it's very important in any negotiation to have the respect of the other side of the table and to be able to be reasonable and to kind of give credence to points that you may not have thought of and that may have some credibility. So I think part of being successful in any negotiation is establishing your own credibility that you're not just bargaining for an unreasonable position, that you believe in what you're negotiating for and you have good, sound, credible reasons for negotiating for those objectives and that outcome. And I think you can establish a relationship across the table and a credibility over time that can help as you move forward.
So everyone would agree the game is in unbelievable shape financially, on the ice, the skill levels off the charts, that, you know, a couple of those work stoppages were the only way to get there. Do you still, when you're out and about, though, have people say to you, please don't have another one?
Oh, we don't want another one. I mean, I say that to myself. And you know, we'll do everything we can to avoid having another one. You know, nobody's a fan of work stoppages, for sure. And you know, they're always a last resort and nothing other than a last resort. You know what? I think for the most part, probably was there for a while in terms of kind of a bitterness toward missing a full season back in 2004, 2005. But I think there's much more positivity about the league and where it is. And I think there's a grudging acknowledgement that a lot of our ability to grow and become the sport we are and the entertainment product we are has to do with some of the things we had to negotiate for and how to draw a line in sand on in 2004, 2005. So I think, you know, the fans that I interact with acknowledge that the sport's never been in a better place than it is today. And a lot of that has to do with what we've been able to achieve in collective bargaining.
Okay, so just the one thing on this. Take us into the room, that 27-hour negotiating span.
Which one?
The one that saved the season. What do you remember about that night?
I remember, you get to a certain point in negotiations where you kind of have small rooms and bigger rooms and kind of subgroups and bigger groups. And so we were in a process where we were kind of shuttling back and forth and having kind of hour-long sessions, and then we'd caucus, and then we'd have another hour-long session, caucus. And I think we were basically making progress, ticking through a fairly long list of open items. But, you know, you knew you were in kind of the final stages of a negotiation. You were hoping to get there by the end of the night, particularly because we were kind of right at the end. I'm not sure, you know, whether we'd made an announcement or whether, you know, it was days away of having to go the same route that we went in 2004, 2005. But I think, look, my own view of the, you know, you're describing the 2012, 2013 negotiation was from the start that this was not the same type of negotiation that we had in 04, 05, that ultimately we were going to get to an agreement in time to play hockey in the 2012, 2013 season. It was particularly frustrating to me that for the issues that we were fighting over, that it took as long as it took to get there. And, you know, I have theories and pretty good ones on why that was the case, but it was what it was. And we did what we had to do, and we achieved the agreement we ultimately needed to achieve. And you know, Gary be the first to tell you that, you know, from our perspective, we felt like we could have achieved the exact same agreement, you know, 4 months earlier. It just wasn't in the cards, and that's unfortunate. But, you know, we turn the page, we move on. I remember, you know, I had a hotel room in the city that night in a different hotel, and I still remember kind of leaving. It was probably 6:30, 7 in the morning, and leaving with the commissioner and kind of walking back to the hotel. And, you know, it's kind of a bittersweet kind of sense, emotion. You're happy that it's done, and you're still kind of disappointed that, you know, it took until mid-January to get there. And then you're excited about what the future holds. And, you know, one of the big accomplishments that we got in our last agreement was really the term of the agreement, because, you know, one of the things that's really fueled the growth of the business and of the league and of the sport is the extended period of labor peace that agreement was able to deliver. And you know, by its term, it's a 10-year agreement, which would mean it doesn't expire until 2022. We did build in an ability, as people know, for either side to reopen that 8 years into the agreement, which would have it expire in 2020. But it was a long-term agreement. It was the longest-term agreement this league has ever entered into. And I think it served the sport very, very well.
But you didn't have champagne when it was over, right? You're a beer drinker, which I think speaks to a little bit about how folks would say about you that you're someone that they could, you know, sit down next to. I think it was Don Maloney who said that he's the type of guy who could be commissioner who you could sit down next to and have a beer with. Is that you? Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm not a, you know, I have tried to expand my repertoire from time to time, but I would say I'm basically a beer drinker for sure.
And how many times or how often do people ask you when you're going to become the next commissioner? Not that I'm asking.
You know, not that often. I don't think that often. I mean, sometimes it comes up in a conversation. But, you know, I think most of the people I interact with understand, you know, the person I'm working for, his passion for the sport, his support within the sport. You know, and I do as well. So, you know, that comes with a job, and it's actually a great part of the job, because, you know, I couldn't have a better person to work for every day, and to, you know, who supports me and supports my back and has really fostered my career. So, you know, that's nothing that, like, is a focus of mine. I love coming to work every day and doing what I do.
Yeah, for sure. You seem so comfortable in your own skin and your partnership with Gary Bettman, which it seems to really be. You know, he says a lot, and I know you have said that you're of a like mind, and you are on the same page about a lot of things. I want to know what's different about you, and how do you differ from him?
You know, I think we have somewhat different personalities. I don't even know how to describe that, and because I could see the wheels twisting in your head there in terms of the follow-up question on that. But, you know, so I think we share a lot of views with respect to kind of how the business should be run and how the business should grow. But we have different personal lives, and you know, there's a lot about the way he conducts himself in his personal life that I really admire and have aspired to in terms of improving my personal life. So it's great, but, you know, and you know, he'd be somebody I'd want to go out to dinner with or have a beer with, although he wouldn't drink as many as I. but, you know, he has his own life and I have my own life. And, you know, what's great for me is that, you know, the relationship we've established where, you know, he said it to me from day one. He said, we have to get to a point. I want to get to a point where we know each other well enough where we can complete each other's sentences. And that, he said that, you know, from the day he hired me. And I think we have achieved that. You know, I can go into a media interview not having heard how he answered the same questions and can answer the questions the same way. And so that talks about how aligned we are in terms of our philosophies, what's important to the league, you know, what what is important to disclose and what's important to keep confidential. We both have a good sense of where that line is. The other thing I respect about Gary, and probably catches a lot of people by surprise, is how open he is to others' views. I mean, for a man as intelligent as he is, and with his intellect, to give credence to other people's views, and to really allow them to sway his view if he agrees with it or if he can get there, is really admirable. And I think that what makes him as effective as he is he has an open mind. He's willing to listen to other people's views, and he's willing to be swayed.
I did read where you had said once, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, a couple things that you wanted to do better in your business life. And you mentioned you wanted to delegate more. And then you also had said something that caught my eye, where you said that you were sometimes more available and approachable to those outside the NHL and outside the organization than you were to those inside the organization. Do you feel like over the last 5 years or so that's changed for you?
It's gotten better. I think it's gotten better for sure. But I continue to think I can be a better manager than I am. And it's a poor excuse, but sometimes you feel like you're almost too busy to have the necessary interactions you need to have with an organization this big. So that's still an area I can definitely improve on. Delegation I've gotten better at. We have such qualified people here at the league that you really can delegate and feel comfortable delegating important jobs and know that they'll be taken care of. So I've gotten better on that. I've gotten better on both, but there's still ways to go.
Okay, so last thing, on their bucket list that you haven't done yet that you're going to get to in the next few months?
I think professionally, it's a good question. I mean, I feel very fortunate in what I've, what I've experienced here at the National Hockey League, what we've done collectively to grow the sport. I'd like to continue to grow it, on the same basis that we've grown it over time. I still want to be a contributing part to doing that. Whatever that brings with it, that brings with it. And I'm open for those challenges. We don't want to dwell on collective bargaining, but I'd love it if we can, have a very efficient, effective negotiation with the Players Association to extend labor peace for a long time to come. And I think the sport would benefit from that.
You don't want them to reopen it, right?
I don't. But again, ultimately that's up to them.
All right, we can end there. Thank you so much. I know I speak for many who are glad that you found a home here at the NHL. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Deb. Happy New Year.
Yeah, you too. That's Bill Daly, Deputy Commissioner of the National Hockey League. And as always, when we have these executives on, you learn so much about them. His journey, so interesting. So we thank him for sharing his story with us. And don't you forget to subscribe to the Executive Suite on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. So until next time, I'm Deb Placey in the NHL Executive Suite.